spent the last 3 weeks now in a series of lessons called Why Are You Not a Christian? So this will be our fourth and final lesson on this subject. And the question is, why are you not a Christian, if indeed you're not? Now, I realize that most of this audience is sympathetic to the gospel and or is already Christians. I get that. I understand that. But nonetheless, we want to be able to reach out to those who are not, and we have to address their questions or their rebuttals or their rejections so far. So I'm asking those people, with all the evidence of God's existence, with all that He has revealed to you, with all that He has done to forgive you and to save your soul, to bring you into fellowship with Him, even though you don't deserve it, even though there's nothing you can do on your own to make that happen, why are you still holding out? Why would anyone still hold out in light of all that? And we might ask the question then, what has so convinced you otherwise? What proofs, what reasons are so compelling that you would reject this that God has offered, but accept that other thing instead? So far, we've examined a number of typical responses from such people. Not one of them has held up under any critical scrutiny. In fact, many of them manifest an outright misrepresentation of the New Testament Christianity, and all of them have been reduced to, I don't want to change, or God doesn't meet my expectations. Those two basic groups of responses there. We have one last area to consider, and one which I am most sympathetic, simply because I struggle with this too, and maybe you do as well. Unfortunately, it is difficult to carry on a rational conversation with some people on this subject because it often descends, and quickly, into emotions and hugely subjective opinions. People tend to argue with their emotions as opposed to bringing evidence and sound reasoning, which is supposed to lead to an inescapable conclusion. But they reason with their emotions instead, and they say things like, well, because I feel so strongly or so passionately about this subject here, or I can argue so passionately about it, therefore I must be right, or something to that effect. Or, because God doesn't make sense to me, therefore He can't possibly make sense to anyone else, which is another way of saying I can't possibly be wrong. Or they'll assume a God-like authority in the sense that they are able and apparently willing to hold God accountable to their own expectations and determine then who God is, what He must do, and how He has to respond. And if He doesn't do those things, well, then He's not God. And if He doesn't do those things because it doesn't meet my expectations, then maybe He just doesn't exist at all. And it's that kind of logic that we're being contending with all the time. And it's not rational logic. And it's amazing because I'm told over and over that Christians are irrational, and that their faith is irrational. But what I'm telling you is that these responses are irrational, and yet these are offered as reasonable, justifiable responses to why I am not a Christian. And I'm waiting for someone to come up with a rational explanation, a reasonable, justifiable explanation that makes all of this that God has offered a moot point and irrelevant, and makes their decision and their compelling evidence so much more believable. I'm still waiting for that. Regardless of what happens, though, in all of that, we would all do well to examine the subject at hand, no matter what we presently believe. Because it's a difficult subject, and it needs to be examined. And by the way, there's no way that I can do this in one lesson. Not the way it deserves. So we're just going to look at the subject and say, there it is. There's a lot more to say about it, but there it is. And basically it comes down to this. I will not believe in a God who allows human suffering to exist, or allows so much suffering to exist, or it upsets me so much to see so much suffering that I just can't reconcile that with a good God. Or some will go so far as to say it's wrong for God to allow human suffering, and therefore, whether they realize it or not, they have just indicted God with a moral judgment. Not only are you unwise to do this, but you are evil in doing this, because that's what wrong means. And I can sympathize with this subject to some degree, because I myself am appalled by the suffering that we see all around us, especially that for which there seems to be no known or apparent reason. Now, I'll just give you some examples. a family man in the area here was going to pick up some relatives at an airport. He's randomly shot in a drive-by shooting. It had nothing to do with the shooters. They had nothing to do with him. He just happened to be in the way. And he was killed as a result. I know of a 15-year-old girl years ago who lost her leg to cancer, and then she died of cancer anyway about a year later. I know of a couple of people who were heading home on I-90. Part of the rock cliff gave way and killed them. Everyone in the car was killed. And what's interesting about that story is because we were with the Hoggards and we were coming on that highway, we were there just about an hour before all that happened. We passed by that same place. I know of statistically, hundreds of innocent children are abducted, sexually assaulted, and killed every year in America. I know that there's a lot of bombs that are going off in the world, bombs that target innocent people, random victims. They don't care. Just indiscriminately maiming or killing people all over the world all the time. I know that statistically, 1.2 billion people in the world live in extreme poverty, living on less than $1.25 a day. And that 2.6 million children, innocent children, die in the world every year due to hunger and malnutrition. It's not hard to find statistics on human suffering, and it's not hard to be appalled by those statistics. But nonetheless, much of what we see does fall into four basic categories of suffering. First of all, there is the self-inflicted suffering, which we tend to ignore as in the subject of suffering. But self-inflicted suffering means it's a result of your own poor decisions, your own poor choices, your own poor judgment, or your own dangerous or reckless living. Poor diet, poor lifestyle, poor or debilitating habits, poor choices, wicked behavior, all kinds of things like that. Are you really going to blame God for those things that you chose to do, that bring upon your own suffering? Is that really a good reason to blame God for that? Or should we talk about inflicted suffering here, where someone else is causing the suffering? You didn't ask for it. You didn't make a decision about it. It just happened to you. And the result of someone else's poor choices there, in other words. Are you going to withhold your love for God because of what someone else did to you? Are you going to hold God responsible and guilty for what someone else did to you? Not what God did, but what someone else did. Or there's the random accidents category, or random afflictions, where cancers, diseases, debilitating sicknesses fall into play, or just being in the wrong place at the wrong time. You're not necessarily being singled out, but you become an inexplicable victim there. And the question here would be, are you sure that God's responsible for that? I mean, are you certain? Are we going to hold God accountable for something like that when we don't really know how to explain it in the first place? And then there's a so-called natural evil. That's what people term it anyway. And that would refer to earthquakes, tornadoes, tsunamis, drought, mudslides, like what took out the town of Oso, Washington here not too long ago. I mean, that's what would fall into that category there. Things for which no person seems to be responsible, but are called, by the insurance people anyway, acts of God. And we've already looked at this idea. If evil is a moral attribute, then is God morally responsible because he created the physical world? Does that make him responsible for everything that happens in the physical world to people? Or because he didn't prevent those things from happening, is he now morally responsible for that? That's like making automobile manufacturers morally responsible for every traffic accident because they built the cars that got into the accidents. I mean, it's that kind of logic, but people don't see it that way. And I'm going to talk on that natural evil thing here in a few moments. But first of all, before we continue, you have to understand, you have to recognize that this very subject of human suffering is a difficult one because there's no universal definition for it. There's no universal measurement of it. It's a very subjective term. Because, granted, we can see someone who is suffering from some horrible tragedy, but people suffer in other ways, too, and there's a lot of subjectivity to that, a lot of self-diagnosis, if you will. You might suffer over something that's happened to you, but the same thing could happen to me, and I won't suffer at all, or vice versa, or I'll suffer very little, and I'll go, well, yeah, it's a bad thing, I didn't want it to happen, but life goes on, and for you, it's the end of the world, or vice versa. Okay? Why is that? Because there is no universal definition or measurement of human suffering. even if the affliction is the same for a group of people, not everyone in that group suffers in equal amounts or to the same degree or in the same way. We have a number of variables, and I'm talking about a big subject here in a very brief way, but just to throw this out, there's a number of variables or factors that have to be considered when you're talking about suffering. One is one's physical age. How old are they? Because they're going to suffer differently depending on how old they are, or their gender. Males suffer differently than females and vice versa, even in the same thing. Culture has a part. One's threshold of pain or their pain tolerance. Their religious beliefs play into that. Or there's the what happened exactly, because that affects how you suffer, or how did it happen exactly, because that affects suffering, or who did this to me, that affects suffering as well. So there's a number of things. You can't just say, well, I'm suffering, because that by itself is an ambiguous statement that really doesn't have any concrete, tangible point of reference by itself. We're not saying that suffering doesn't exist. What we're saying is it's difficult to pinpoint always what suffering actually is, and then how to measure that. And you notice also that not all suffering is physical in nature or can be relieved in a physical way. Well, hunger is suffering, especially if you're the one afflicted with hunger, right? But we can resolve that by giving you food. And same with much of human sickness in the world. We can remove that suffering with medicine or improved sanitation or improved hygiene. Forced slavery is certainly an oppressive suffering that people have to endure, but the removal of the powers that be can remove the suffering. Those are physical things. But what about the one who suffers from irreparable loss, such as one who suffers a loss, especially the seemingly untimely loss of a spouse or the loss of a child? Or someone who's suffering from guilt of their own sins, or the anguish of just living in an unrighteous world, such as what Christ must have experienced himself. You can't fix those things with food and medicine and a change in the regime. You can't fix those things with physical things. What that leads us to, then, is that suffering can not only be physical, it can also be mental, it can be emotional, and it can be spiritual in nature. Well, that broadens the picture immediately, doesn't it? Now we're talking about a big subject that just got a whole lot bigger. What's interesting about all that, though, is that evolution cannot explain all of that. Ironically, the fact that we do suffer, the fact that human beings do suffer in all those different ways, is more proof for the existence of a creator who made us rather than that we just evolved biologically in accidental mutations over eons and eons of time. Because if you think about it logically, there's no reason for suffering if we are purely natural beings, biological beings who have no soul. There's no reason for suffering. We cannot reduce the subject of human suffering, is what I'm getting at, to a mere theological discussion, because real people in the world really do suffer. And some people suffer all the time, and some people suffer in manner beyond words. They just can't even comprehend it, nor can they explain it, nor would we believe it if they told us. We just can't grasp that. But that goes outside of our particular lesson because our examination of suffering is very specific. We're looking at, is God to blame for the suffering? Is he responsible? And then secondly, is human suffering a justifiable reason to blame God or to reject God? That's the subject at hand. That's what we're looking at this morning. So we're not just looking at the subject of human suffering, which is huge, and it would take us weeks to even do justice to, but we're actually looking at something very specific about human suffering. Is this a reason why you should reject God and not become a Christian? Because there is human suffering in the world. Last week, we talked about that it was not God who brought sin into the world or brought it or created sin, rather, but rather it was man's disobedience against his Creator. And as a result of that, there were curses against man's circumstances as well as against man's physical environment, the world itself. The ground was cursed because of what man did against his creator. And that creates all kinds of suffering. When God curses the world because of man's sin, well, then we feel the negative effects of that. But who caused that? Who really made that happen? It wasn't God acting capriciously or randomly or arbitrarily. It was us who, all of us, in that we've all copied Adam and Eve, we have all sinned against God, and we get what we deserve in that sense. In Genesis chapter 6, verse 5, this is right before God floods the world there. It says that the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was evil continually. Why did God destroy the world in a flood? Well, because God was just an angry, impetuous God who just does things randomly without purpose, right? Or he's an evil God who just has it in for certain people at certain times, and he just kind of, you know, gets unhinged every now and then and just blows up in a storm of anger. No, that's not it at all. I mean, he's telling you in his revealed word exactly the reason why he did what he did. He's simply responding to the situation that men created. God didn't destroy the world with a flood because of his wickedness, but because of man's wickedness. And the scripture promises that he will destroy it again, not with water, but with fire, but for the same reason, because of man's wickedness. It will be destroyed. Matthew chapter 15, verse 19, Jesus says, "For out of the human heart come evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, slanders." God's not responsible for such evils. They are found in men's wicked hearts. They are the products of men's desire for their own lust, which is what James talks about in James chapter 1, verse 13 through 16, which we won't go over in this lesson, but you can read it on your own. James says there that God is not evil, God is not tempted by evil, and he doesn't tempt you with evil. But rather, your own evil and all the suffering that results from your own evil comes from your own desire to gratify your own ungodly lusts. And when I say yours, I mean mine too, because we've all done this. We've got that evil desire in us, and we gave life to that. And that manifested itself in sinful behavior. And then we suffer, or others suffer, because of that sinful behavior. And even if we don't suffer directly from our own decisions, we live among billions of people who are all trying to gratify their own personal lusts, their own cravings, their own wicked indulgences. And honestly, that's taking its toll on all of us. You don't live in a vacuum. You don't live on a deserted island where it's only you that you're contending with. And even if you did, there's still the physical world that's under a curse because of sin that people caused. You can't get away from it. In other words, what I'm saying is you can't get away from human suffering in one sense or another. But you're a part of that. We are a part of that. The world has brought that on itself. Someone says, well, what about natural evil? You know, like earthquakes and tornadoes, those are things that men didn't cause and men aren't responsible for. That's a good question. But the first thing I would like to ask is, who said that nature could be evil? Why are you going to assign a moral attribute to something that is non-living, to something that can't make a decision? An earthquake is not evil. It's not good either. What I'm saying, it's not morally one way or the other. It's just something that happens. Tornadoes aren't good or evil. They're just something that happens. It's a meteorological event, nothing more or less than that. You say, well, yeah, but it destroys people and their homes. Yes, it does that, but let's understand that it's still just a physical or meteorological event. Now, likely, I'm not going to be able to answer all your questions here, but first of all, leveling a charge against God, especially without proof, puts you in a very perilous situation, especially when you should know that you are going to stand before God someday and talk to him, or rather I should say, he will talk to you, and he's going to bring up this charge of yours, this accusation of yours, if indeed that's what you want to stand by. If you're going to sit there and shake your fist and rail against God and say, God, you're morally responsible because you created this world and this things in this world, events in this world, kill people, and that makes you culpable or responsible for those people's deaths, well, that's a pretty heady charge there, isn't it? And you're going to answer for that. I'm trying to show you that there's a way where you don't have to get into that situation. How about if you step back and look at the situation realistically? Not emotionally, because I'm not appealing to your emotions, but realistically. The fact is, we live on a dynamic planet that is controlled by forces and physics and cycles that are beyond our control, beyond your control. And for that very reason, you and I ought not to be surprised that sometimes people get hurt by those things. The physical forces of nature are, as you see on the screen, not only uncontrolled by us, but they are amoral, which is meaning not moral, neither good nor evil, not capable of being good or evil, not capable of making moral choices one way or the other. Tornadoes don't appear or make themselves or bring themselves into existence so they can go out and kill people. And even if they didn't kill people, that doesn't make them good tornadoes, okay? So you can't sit there and assign a moral value to something that is amoral. And they are also unsympathetic to human concerns or our pain or even our life or death. They don't care because they can't care. They're incapable. It's like asking a rock to care about you or to not care about you. It's a rock. It just can't do that. It doesn't even have the capacity to do that. I had a rock up here. Anyway, earlier from an earlier lesson, I could have brought that up. But the whole point here is that they are unsympathetic to human pain or to human loss. Ironically, then here's the irony once again, is that evolution claims that blind forces of nature are all responsible for why we're here. Why don't the insurance adjusters start blaming blind forces of nature instead of calling them acts of God? Isn't that interesting? I hope I didn't cause that. So when we talk about this phrase of act of God here, it does not accurately describe the situation. It does rightly admit that God is the creator. But it wrongly assumes that he is responsible to protect everyone at all times. And there's no proof for that. I mean, you can feel that way if you want to, but it's just your feeling. You can have that opinion if you want to, but it's just your opinion. And it imposes upon God a privately held belief rather than offers any evidence or proofs whatsoever. In other words, a person is basically saying, well, in my personal belief, I believe that God should have prevented all those deaths that were caused by that earthquake, tsunami, tornado, etc. And therefore, since he didn't, I hold God guilty. How are you holding God morally guilty for an opinion that you came up with? How does that work? I'm asking, how is that rational? How is that reasonable? For example, if I believe that God ought to be personally and unconditionally preserve every human life, then that stands to reason, if that is true, a good premise there, then wherever people build houses or build cities, that must automatically become an earthquake-free, tornado-free, infestation-free, and flood-free zone, because those things are not supposed to happen where people build their houses. Right? I mean, it has to be that way if that's where you're going to go with that. And then you have to ask the question, is God really going to miraculously alter all the meteorological, geophysical, and hydraulic forces of the earth to accommodate where we choose to live so that nobody gets hurt? Is that what you're really asking God to do? Is that really what you expected him to do? And who are you to expect him to do that? Who are you to call that? Who are you to negotiate with God in that way? And then hold him accountable when he doesn't satisfy your opinion, your preference, your privately held belief. Once again, this whole series of lessons has been, come let us reason together. Does that make sense? I'll switch gears a little bit. Talk about the purpose of suffering here. Because God never said that all suffering is useless. Jesus Christ never put an end to all suffering. Christian religion doesn't expect this or teach that that is necessary. So where does this come from? In essence, where the idea comes from that suffering is useless or pointless or doesn't need to be here is from people who want heaven on earth without having to wait for it. That's really what it comes down to. I just put into the mouths of those people what they're telling me through their actions and their preferred beliefs and everything else. And you say, well, you didn't have the right to do that. But that's what they're telling me. That's what they're saying. They feel entitled because they are alive and because they're human that therefore they should not have to suffer. Well, that's an opinion, not an argument. That's a privately held belief, not any kind of proof. And that's just merely an expectation and nothing more. Let's turn over to James chapter 1, verse 2 through 4, for example. And keep in mind, I know that this is written to Christians, not just to people in the world. But nonetheless, look at what it says to those Christians in James chapter 1, starting in verse 2, where he says, "Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And let endurance have its perfect result, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing." Then jump down to verse 12. "Blessed is a man who perseveres, for once he has been approved, receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him." What James is saying in essence is, Christians, you're going to suffer not only in the world, like the world suffers, everyday human suffering, like everyone else does, but you're going to suffer on top of that because you're a Christian. Your faith in God is going to lead to a conflict with the world, and you're going to suffer for that decision. If you're going to uphold the belief in God and hold to the belief in Christianity and you're going to preach the gospel of Christ, if you're going to hold to all that, well, then you're going to bring upon yourself various trials that go above and beyond all the suffering that other people experience as well. And but what does he say about that? If you approach this subject in faith that there is a God, that he is a rewarder of those who seek him, Hebrews 11:6 says that, then this will lead to joy and not misery. Various trials in the context likely can be anything that challenges a Christian's faith, but it's not limited to that. In essence, it's whatever tempts a person to question God, like the subject of human suffering, tempts people to question God. But there's great joy for those people if that's what draws them near to God. Because there's human suffering, I want to rise above that. How can I do that? Well, in this life, it's impossible. But in a life with God that carries over into the hereafter, that is not only possible, but it is guaranteed if you have faith and live by faith in this God. That changes everything. That's why we call it a game changer, okay? Because it changes everything when you start seeing it in that perspective. And notice, too, that God does not apologize, because he doesn't have to, for our suffering, whether it's in the world or for the Christian faith. He's not apologizing for what's happening in the world because, honestly, we brought it on ourselves through our sins. And if it wasn't our sins, well, then it's human sin, okay? So we brought it on ourselves. Or if it's for the faith, well, he's not apologizing for that, because it actually is exactly that causes us to persevere and improve our character and refine us and so on. So he's not apologizing because he hasn't done us any wrong. He hasn't done us any harm there. Whatever forces us to have more faith in him is not altogether bad, but is beneficial. Good actually can come from something that is bad. It is human suffering, not self-gratification, that refines our character, forces us to become strong, forces us to rethink our purpose here on this earth, and melts away all those petty little things that get in the way. In other words, as you see on the screen, it's human suffering that snaps us back to reality. And it is often through personal suffering, not comfort and ease, but personal suffering, that people are drawn to God for help, for answers, for consolation, yes, for salvation. And you have to wonder how many people are going to be in heaven with God, not because they suffered on earth so much, but because of that suffering, they turned to God for help and found his gospel and put their trust in him and believed in him and walked with him for the rest of this life through the threshold of death itself and into the life with God. How many people will be there because human suffering is actually what triggered that all along? It is through suffering, not comfort and ease, that Jesus Christ proved himself worthy. He couldn't prove himself worthy unless he was willing to endure suffering in his obedience. But having done that, he proved himself worthy through his own intrinsic virtue, and he took care of our problem. Remember, that's where the series all began. We have a big, big problem. He took care of that problem, provided us with that big solution that we need, and he made the promise of heaven real and doable for anyone who wants it. Not all suffering is bad. There is a purpose to suffering if you look beyond this world and recognize that you were not meant just for this world. You were meant for more than this. In sharp contrast to that, our medical establishment, with all of its technology, pharmacology, sophisticated surgeries and procedures, has conditioned us to believe that you are not supposed to suffer because, whether they say it or not, they're implying it, all suffering is bad. And what that creates among us is a mentality that seeks the alleviation of suffering instead of people trying to be morally responsible to God. In fact, not only the medical establishment, but even people who are seeking that alleviation will accept very unethical procedures in their pursuit of the alleviation of suffering, because after all, it is wrong to suffer and you are not meant to suffer. Therefore, we need to get rid of suffering no matter who we have to step on, what we have to do, whether it's good or bad. And it's no wonder, given all that, that we have become a nation addicted to pills and prescriptions and narcotics. And alcohol, and marijuana, and pornography, and video gaming, and movies, and all kinds of surreal escapism, rather than a nation that honors God and seeks to do what is right. Because after all, we were not meant to suffer, and these things all minimize or alleviate our suffering, even if it's for a brief moment of time, because we all believe that we're not supposed to suffer, and we are entitled to a lifestyle that keeps us away from suffering. And that's all had a very positive effect on our world, hasn't it? Oh, no. And don't forget, too, that Christ himself saw human suffering firsthand, and he did relieve some of it, but only in as much as it was necessary to show that he possessed the power and authority to relieve all of it. Not in this life, but rather in the life to come. Christ came to relieve human suffering at its darkest level and in its worst form, and that would be the burden of sin itself. That is our problem. And the atheists say, well, if Jesus had the power to heal the blind, then why not remove blindness? And the answer to that is simply, while the blind and deaf and lame do suffer, there's no question, all of that suffering is limited to this life. Christ provided freedom from suffering for the eternity to come. Which is the greater suffering? You should ask yourself that. Suffering in this limited, finite life, or suffering in our separation from God for eternity, for which there is no recourse? Given that, which did Christ address? Not the physical human suffering over here, but rather the spiritual suffering that all people endure who reject God, who will not become Christians, who reject all the evidence that God has provided and choose to shake their fist at God for their own principles and their own reasons, for their opinions and their excuses, for their self-justifications and their expectations. But that doesn't really help them in the end, does it? And someone says, well, see, that in itself is unfair. God going to make a whole bunch of people suffer for eternity just for a few sins on earth. That's usually how that's put, something to that effect. The first response to that would be, I question the few sins in the first place. My understanding is the more and more I learn about Scripture, the more and more I learn about God in Scripture, the more I realize how pervasive sin actually is. We think that we're not sinning when we don't kill people or rob banks and things like that. The fact is, we are a very unholy people, left to ourselves, and unholy in ways that we probably don't even imagine. The second response to that would be that that magnifies an ignorance of what sin is to God. In other words, there's someone just basically saying to you, I don't understand the nature of the crime. But I'm going to tell God that he's wrong to do this, even though I don't understand the nature of the crime against him. And then thirdly, it is not unfair if God warned you ahead of time what was going to happen to you if you sin and then reject his solution for your problem. That's not unfair for him to give you exactly what he promised he would do to you if you did that rejection. And having revealed his will to all mankind through the gospel, God is not only warning that eternal suffering does most certainly exist, but he's also revealing how you can escape that through the blood of Christ, through obedience to the gospel of Christ. Where's the unfairness in that? As I said, this is a huge, huge subject, and this lesson can't possibly do justice, and yet our question still remains very specific. Is human suffering a deal breaker as to why you will not, cannot become a Christian? The question of human suffering, when examined rationally and realistically, compels us to look beyond this world to our completion rather than within this world. As I said, we were meant for more than this. It's obvious that we were not meant to be here only, but that we look forward to and anticipate a life beyond this, outside of this suffering here. This world is filled with sorrow and suffering and pain and separation and darkness and death. We're not denying that, but God has promised us a place in his world that is untouched by human sin, untouched by human weakness and frailty, where none of those things that I just mentioned exist. None of them exist. And that can be yours. Someone says, yeah, but you're saying that only Christians get to go there, and that's not fair. No, what we're saying is only those who are forgiven by God are allowed to go there. And those who live by faith in God, having been forgiven, are allowed to go there. But the only way that that is possible is to become a Christ follower. Yes, to become a Christian and live by faith in him. And you are right when you say that, that it is not fair in one respect, because left to itself, not a single Christian has earned that right or deserves that privilege or is owed that kind of favor from God. It is by grace through faith that we are saved, not by human merit or human progress or human power or your own personal effort. But what makes God's plan work is that the fairness is made possible through Christ's sacrificial death, an act of human suffering far worse than any of us can ever comprehend. And he did all that just to save your soul. He did that for you. So the question still remains, if indeed you're not a Christian, why aren't you a Christian? Why are you not a Christian? Or we could say, as we've said in earlier lessons, if you're not living like a Christian, having become one, why aren't you living like a Christian when you know all this? You agreed to it one time. So far, there's been no good reason offered, and we have pleaded with you to consider rationally those reasons and to look at them in examination of critical scrutiny. So we could ask the question this way. What will your resistance do for you when you leave this world? How will your defiance or your procrastination or your simple disbelief, in whatever sense it is, how is that going to help you? And once again, we can ask the question, who has come from the other side? Who's come from the afterlife to tell you, to confirm for you absolutely with proof that you can be defiant and you can be procrastinating and you can be unbelieving, but there's a place for you in God's world where everything's going to be all right after all. And you can join with all the other ungodly people who rejected Christ, and they're all your friends here on earth. They've gone ahead, and all the relatives that have gone ahead, they're all waiting for you because there's one big reunion coming up and a big party, and you're all going to just celebrate being dead. Who's come from the other side to tell you all that? Because the only ones that have come from the other side to tell you anything have told you the opposite of all that. Why are you going to believe what no one has any proof for? And why are you going to disbelieve what someone has offered proof for? That just doesn't make sense, sir. I'd like you to consider this passage as we close. It's part of our scripture reading this morning, 1 Peter 4, verse 17 through 19. Think about what Peter says. It's time for judgment to begin with the household of God, the church, in other words, Christians. And if it begins with us first, what will be the outcome for those who don't obey the gospel of God? And if it is with difficulty that the righteous is saved, what will become of the godless man and the sinner? Therefore, those also who suffer according to the will of God shall entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. What he's saying is that Christians are going to suffer for their faith. That's to be expected. We sign on for that. We accept that. We know that's going to happen. Well, what's going to happen if you're not a Christian? You're going to suffer too. Not for your faith, because you don't have it. But you're going to suffer, not only in this life, but you're going to suffer terribly in the life to come. And God's trying to spare you from that. So let these words sink into your head. What will become of you if you resist this message? Well, what will become of you if you resist the trust of your Creator? But if you put your soul and your trust and your faith in that Creator, you can have confidence in what lies ahead. Which makes more sense right now to what I just said? You suffering in this life and then going on to suffer in the life to come, or putting up with temporary suffering in this life, and especially as a Christian, but going on to an eternity where there is no suffering, with a God who not only loves you, but is going to shower you with blessings that never end. Which of those sounds better? God wants you to become a Christian and to live by faith. We want you to become a Christian and live by faith. The question comes down to, as it always does, what do you want? What exactly do you want? That's our lesson this morning. If you need to respond, if you're ready to become a Christian, well, what are you waiting for? Come forward, be baptized into Christ if that's your desire, as we stand and sing the song that Richard has selected for us.